freeze. Cripes. We had to withstand some substantial pressure from people like Senator Stevens, right? Right now he's very good with us, but back then he owed his political life to Wally Hickel. Right? Because Wally Hickel had appointed him senator when Senator Bartlett died. And during the time that Hickel was governor, of course, he had to deal with us. And we had chopped off this opportunity to make these land selections, and he was climbing a wall. He's one of these go, go, go types, right? Nothing will get in his way, right? And here we were, just kind of cutting him off at the pass, and they were going wild. And it wasn't very much fun around Alaska back then, because the emotion was hot and heavy. And so every which way, they of course tried to affect our thinking about what to do. They wanted us to be easy, but of course we were fighting desperately for our people. Of course we weren't using bows and arrows and guns and stuff, but we were doing the best we could with what tools we had available.
What forces do you think brought that generation together in that shape? That may be a difficult question to answer, but I'm curious that, I mean, all of the forces are conspiring to prevent a settlement, to prevent unity, and then there's a generation in their 20s and 30s that now comes together in a different way, different from the way their parents would have done, and what, I'm wondering what forces did that.
I don't know. I guess there's, you know, in the, sometimes there's just, you know, things happen. I mean, the people develop to a point where, I guess, events occur, you know, and some people are just there. And I suppose it's not unlike what happened in the founding of the country. Right? I mean, with America, and the kind of government that was created, and the type of people that were involved in the creation of that constitution, and the handling of issues, the experience of the different people that created the constitution. Eventually was reflected in what occurred, and in this instance, it was a rather, you know, kind of a unique occurrence, as a matter of fact. I mean, none of us really had ever intended to be involved in this type of thing. It just so happened that, for one reason or another, we had experienced different things that to one degree or another helped frame our thinking. And I mean, like, you know, Charlie went to BIA school, at Mount Edgecombe. Came from Barrow. I don't know what occurred that motivated him to think the way he did about things up there, but nevertheless, you know, which to me kind of shows you the idiocy of our system. And here is a guy with a great mind, really. Who had a certain talent, a certain way of seeing, but was sort of muffled in the system, right, of the Bureau boarding school thing, and you know. I think in many respects is not unlike a lot of young Native students we have today who have something to offer but don't see any relevance in the system or no outlet, right, or no direction. I think Charlie had gone to RCA school too, if I'm not mistaken. You know, a lot of those guys
at that time, like Al Adams, he's in the legislature now, Horace Thompson, a lot of these guys, they got tired of reading books and started to learn something practical, so they went off to electronics school. Well, that kind of exposed them to the country a little bit, you know, the different ways of America, the Americans. And Emil also was an engineer type. He'd been to boarding schools, and he was a little older than the rest of us, and he'd been raised in a different part of the world. And Emil was just the perfect guy, to lead us, because we didn't need some wild hellraiser type who was going to burn the country down, right? We needed somebody who was going to make the state feel good. You know, hopefully, that is some mild person who could sort of be our spokesman, who could feel what we felt, but not go flying out of hand and saying some wild things. And we always felt that it was essential to work in the system, because we knew that the system could come down on us pretty hard. And so our approach was to deal through the system, and Emil was able to express what we needed to. But we all kind of worked together, communicated, and generally didn't. We always tried to make moves that, in effect, were sort of agreeable to the. You know, at least these major groups. For instance, when we had the crisis over Hickel's appointment to become Secretary of Interior, now that was a huge crisis, right? We're the ones that took a lot of pressure. But you see how it appears, John Warbridge was a very articulate person. Not unlike a lot of Southeasterners, right, Tlingits? You know, remember my description about, in fact, he's kind of like a product of their Indian system down there, in a sense that where he knew Robert's rules of order, right, to a T. He spoke precise English. He knew how to conduct himself, and he was older than the rest of us. A real strong individual. And Eben, representing the Arctic Slope. Charlie always was kind of like an outsider up there, you know, even within his own group. For one reason or another, you know, some people are, some people allow people to be places, and some people don't, for one reason or another, depending on their criteria. But even up there, Charlie was always an instigator of good ideas. But Eben was the one that a lot of his people had confidence in to go from A to B to Z, you know, to be more linear in his ability to accomplish things. And Eben and I were, we were different generations, but we saw eye to eye on almost on most everything. But we always needed somebody from the slope, right? Because we never wanted any large group to think that any deals were being cut by anybody else, right? It was sort of, we were protecting each other, you know, from attack. if we sent only one person down there. Like, on one occasion, actually, Emil and I made a trip together,
which is unusual to just send two people. But the first trip that anybody made, really, to try to represent the Alaska Natives was by Emil and myself. And when back in about 68, the Interior Department was going to make some recommendations, its first recommendations about how they were proposing to deal with this question of the land claims. And because we'd been making these vast claims and Udall was not processing the state selections, Greening was still alive then, and he in fact was urging that the federal government pay us off, so to speak. And so they had planned this meeting, which we were not invited to, with all of our delegation. And they had an assistant secretary named Luce, who was now head of Consolidated Edison, the power outfit in New York. Charles Luce, he was a special assistant to Udall. Anyway, we passed the hat, so to speak, in Anchorage and got enough money for him and I to go to Washington. So we assumed that, by God, they're talking about our land and they're not going to sit there and make any decisions without us being there, and so we invited ourselves, right? That's how much gall we had. Anyway, we walked into, I don't know whose office, Senator Bartlett's office, and there everybody was, right? And, Hickel was there, Ed Boyko was there, you know, Bartlett and Greening was there, and maybe Pollock, I forget, yeah. And so we just walked in and just told them, you know, this is our land, and we want to hear what you have to say about what you're proposing to do. And that was one of the early proposals of the Interior Department. It was absolutely asinine as far as we were concerned. You know, I think they were proposing one township, you know, per village, and they were going to propose to give us whatever Alaska was. They fixed the time of taking as of 1867, which would have meant that they were going to give us $7.2 million, right? And then they were going to authorize the Secretary of Interior. No, they were going to authorize the Attorney General of Alaska to go to court on our behalf, right? And hell, we were fighting with him, right? I mean, it was so stupid, it wasn't even funny. But, you know, we had the nerve to go down and do that. And then, in this instance, this was in, when was Nixon elected? 68, huh? Yeah. Well, we had been fighting with Hickel. And because he wanted to undo the land freeze. In the meantime, Bartlett died and he made Stephen senator. In the meantime, Hickel had hired Ed Boyko to be his Attorney General. And as you recall, Hickel stuck his foot in his mouth several times on the question of the environment. And at that time, the environmentalists were just really developing their power, right? I mean, people who had sort of left they were leaving the civil rights thing and sort of moving into the environmental arena. And and so the whole world was coming down on Hickel. And he was having all kinds of trouble because he's saying something that, you can't, you know, believe in conservation for conservation's sake. And what good is a tree looking at a tree in the woods, you know, and not being used, and things of that nature. And he was painted to be a real villain of the environment. Of course, those who were looking for problems with Hickel
They wanted to look for problems in his other responsibility, which is the American Indians, right? And so during the hearing, everybody was loaded to get him. And so we went down there because Emil and John had had a meeting with Hickel before he went down to Washington. And we were trying to determine where he stood with respect to the land freeze, because by God, he was trying to kill the freeze by litigation and everything else while he was governor, which was his duty, as he saw it. But then as Secretary of Interior, he was going to be our trustee, right? He was supposed to be for us under the law. Well, we thought, well, hell, that was kind of hard for us to make the switch. We knew it was going to be tough for him, right? And so so he went down there, and a key advisor was Clifford Grow, an attorney, still alive. I just saw him the other day. He had been a partner of McCutcheon over here, and of course McCutcheon was the one who wanted to control AFN as it was being born. He was the attorney for the Tioga. And Cliff had been involved with the Federation, representing I forget which groups. But he was also very close to Hickel and Stevens. And he had been sent to Washington to help help Wally Hickel through the nomination process in the Interior Committee, Senate Interior Committee. Well, when Emil and John met with Hickel, Hickel wasn't very specific, because all we knew about Hickel was that he claimed that what Udall could do by executive order, I can undo, right? And that executive order was the land freeze, which was our leverage. And because with the land freeze, they couldn't build a pipeline, they couldn't do anything, the state couldn't make its elections, you know, it was frozen. And so Emil John left this breakfast or this meeting with the feeling that he was non-committal. Something to the effect that, well, we'll take care of you. Well, we didn't know what that meant for sure. Well, you know, were they going to do us in there? They're going to protect us. So for the hearing, our board sent us down to Washington, four of us. And in the meantime, Hickel's supporters were working away, getting all kinds of support from every group in Alaska, conceivably from the Girl Scouts to whomever, would send in a telegram urging the senators to confirm Hickel because Alaska wanted a cabinet member, which is understandable. But of course, we went down there to find out about this freeze. Well, we couldn't get near him. I mean, he was so protected because nobody wanted him to say anything asinine again. And so finally he agreed to have breakfast. Well, they didn't want all four. Emil tried to get me to go with John, but I said, no, I said, you and John go, because you're the ones that misunderstood or need to clarify what he said. Well, they would only agree to a breakfast with friends from Alaska, right? Because every other interest group in the country wanted to get next to him. But when they got up to the meeting, hell, they didn't hardly talk about anything. Phone was ringing, and you know, so they came by just, you know, unhappy as hell. But when we first got there, we went to Stephen's office, and we brought Lefty Weisbrot with us, who was John Borbridge's counsel. Stevens, if you all know Stevens, I served in the House with him. And Stevens is one of those little short guys that when he gets mad, he's practically jumping up and down and frothing at the mouth and crying in a high-pitched voice, you know. And we got in there, and Stevens did one of his numbers on us, like, holy smokes, you know, you'd think that we were traitors to the country. You can't do this to us, you know, and screaming and yelling and nailing Lefty Weisbrot you know, sort of accusing the Jewish lawyers from the East of putting stuff in our heads, you know, that was causing Alaskans a lot of problems, you know. When in reality we had been calling the tune and pretty much always did, you know, through this whole process in terms of our strategy. And I was at the point where I was going to get up and just walk out, you know. Here I was, an Alaskan, known him for years, and I wasn't going to let him treat me like that. But I just stood there. We let him go through his number. But see, Cliff Groh, my friend Cliff, was there giving his interpretation of what was going on within the Federation. You know, he was feeding Stevens and he was feeding
Pickle.
And he was supposed to be one of our attorneys. Right? I'd like to have him here to talk to you. In any case, what finally happened was that we saw that we could get no satisfaction in terms of getting any public commitment from Hickel. So we had no choice but to go to the committee. And what we did was, in fact, his response, insofar as the freeze was concerned, was sort of his appointment to the secretaryship was contingent on his response to that. We got Jackson and the committee to agree that he had to maintain that freeze, you know, till this problem was resolved, or that he could not do anything consequential with that freeze without going to the committee to discuss whatever he intended to do. So he finally agreed to it, and from a public standpoint, we supported him. Right? We got up and at the tail end of the hearing and did what we were supposed to do. But in the process of doing this, though, they were getting to our board at home. I mean, our 30-man board or so, and women board, they're singly grabbing certain of our board members. And we were down there, you know, feeling like we'd been betrayed. We said, you guys sent us down there not with a mandate to support him, but to find out his position on the freeze. In the meantime, there's a plane load of people called the Truth Squad, right, of Alaskans, which included some of our own people. Yeah. And let me tell you, that was tough sailing, but, you know, that was a critical move on our part, because if we had lost on the question of the freeze, that would have been our leverage, you see. We had to maintain the leverage of that land freeze, which of course was causing all kinds of consternation with the oil industry and with the Alaskans over the pipeline. So that was just sort of one example of the kind of pressure that we had to take during the process of this land settlement. I got John Borbidge real mad that day because you know, I was ready to celebrate, right? And we got outside the Senate office building there, and John, his counsel was Lefty, and I liked Lefty, he was a good guy. And at that time, we did not have any national counsel, right? We were just shouldering this thing, you know, by ourselves. And we knew that we couldn't really depend on our Alaskan counsel after the kind of scenario we went through there, you know. And so Borbidge says, well, let's go down to Lefty's office and, you know, do this and such. And I said, no, I got it. I said, I'm ready to celebrate. What are you trying to do? Give me a big sales pitch for Lefty? You know, I was just kidding. But, you know, I knew he wanted us to hire Lefty as our AFN counsel. But I nor the others were ready to do that. But I don't know, John, we always got along pretty good. John is kind of an intellectual, you know. And of course I could act like an intellectual but still be a gutter type.
So I got along with everybody.
That was quite an occasion. In fact, if I could ever find it, there was only one writer that I can recall that understood the significance of that particular political move, and that was a writer for the Daily News, who is now the head of the ABC television office in Washington. He used to write for the news. He was
Bob Zelnick was his name.
Wrote an article for the Daily News about that time, and he understood the significance of that move. Anyway, God, if I could only get Emil and Don Wright in the same room together. They don't like each other at all. I mean, it's like blood, you know. But we'll get them separately, maybe, before this course is over. And Borbridge, as you know, is sort of in retirement, and I hear doing a book now. I don't know if that's true. I saw him in Juneau. He's been out of power for how many years? 3 or 4 years now? But he was a very powerful presence during the years that we were fighting for the settlement. And in my opinion, you know, we cannot afford to lose leaders like that as a whole now. Because when a guy like him falls, it weakens us altogether. So consequently, we've thought of trying to figure out ways to help them work out their problems, you know, in each region that might affect a leader that has got lots of potential still. But it would be interesting if we could get John up here. You all heard Byron the other day, didn't you, most of you? Byron Malak, he came up to some deal. Didn't? You guys missed out. Well, I'm going to cut it off here unless you have some questions. I have to go to Selawik next week, so I won't be here. So we'll have some...
We have left it on the desk of the Senate and have every intention to leave it there. So far as I'm concerned, it can stay there. I don't know how soon Senator Magnuson might change his mind, but as far as I'm concerned, we need to determine whether the tuna industry, which opposed the 200-mile limit, is now going to determine how effective it will be in dealing with the problems that develop in terms of the administration of the 200-mile limit and our ability to develop, again, an export market for Alaska-processed, Alaska-caught Alaska pollock. I've been told you've heard about some of these barriers, and those barriers are very real. I find it strange to find that Alaska pollock, again, doesn't have the barrier if it goes in through Korea. Another thing that you may not be aware of is that part of our Alaska pollock excess quota was allocated to Mexico. Mexico has never had a fishery in Alaska waters, and I looked into that to find out why they were interested in Alaska pollock. Well, it turned out that they assigned their quota to Korea. And the reason they got our Alaska pollock was because they gave some concessions to the California fishing fleet in Mexican waters. We are still, whether we like it or not, a small state and a new state without some of the strengths that come from an industry that's been in being, as the California tuna industry has been. And I think that we have to be very careful and very alert to the developments with regard to our fisheries resources and our ability to deal with the foreign markets that could be developed with regard to exports from the harvest of our fisheries resources. Those Asian markets are tremendous opportunities for us when we look at the type of strength that is there. One of the interesting things about being in public office is the ability to go back year after year to the same place and see the changes that are made. I remember the first time I went into Kodiak and some of the vessels that were there, and the first time I was able to travel out along the chain and the small vessels that were there. I don't know how many of you had the occasion to go to Kodiak or out to Cold Bay or Dutch Harbor lately. But if you haven't, you ought to organize, and if you're interested in the development of our fishery potential, you ought to organize a little trip and go out there and see what's there. And you don't see a 30, 40-foot vessels anymore, very few of them. You see some very modern 120, 170-foot vessels manned by very capable, bright, young crews, basically young crews. It's very interesting. Look at the average age of our captains as compared to the average age of the fishing fleets in the rest of the country, and then ask yourself why. Well, we've had several things that have happened. One of the most amazing is the ingenuity of the Alaska fisherman as he has used the new federal laws that have been passed to encourage development. One of them is the capital fund. We now have, most people don't even realize it, the capability for fishermen to put aside the monies they would pay the federal government taxes in a capital fund, and that fund may be used for the modernization or replacement of their vessel. And you might ask, you know, what the hell is he talking about that when he's supposed to be talking about export trade? Let me tell you, the size of those vessels and the number of them is so staggering, when you see them, you wouldn't believe what I'm going to tell you now, and that is there isn't a shipyard in the nation today that would deliver you a vessel of that size in the next 2 years because of orders placed by Alaska fishermen. Our fleets are really on the move, and we are developing the capability to harvest our own fishery resources. We will have a bottom fleet, I think, developed before we have a processing industry that will be capable of handling our fish. And that's one of the great problems we've got now in handling this joint venture bill and the development of joint ventures, particularly with Korea. Because, as I said, they are now getting most of that, and they want to maintain access to that pollock for processing and shipment on to Japan. And we are in some real economic battles that are extremely subtle in terms of the development of legislation that relates to that possibility. But there is no question that the fishing community is responding and sees the opportunity. Now, I think one of the worst things that could happen to the development of our relationships to that East Asian market would be to have a fleet that's capable of catching the fish and no market because of either the lack of the ability to process our fish or because of the trade barriers that have been traditional with regard to exports from the United States into the East Asian market. With regard to petrochemicals, I would be remiss in Fairbanks not to mention that capability, because certainly we are all waiting now for the development of the gas pipeline, which I still believe in, with the hope that one of the spin-offs of that project will be the development of the petrochemical industry here in the interior of Alaska. There is no question but what the development of those gross national products that I mentioned, doubling at least every 7 years, will prove to be an insatiable, again, market dealing with the area of petrochemicals and our transportable, exportable fuels. Just the heavy hydrocarbons will come out of the gas pipeline with a gas conditioning plant if we can get them here. would provide the basis for a petrochemical industry that would be could be sustained for years to come. And I believe that the major goal for that type industry would be to develop the first or second level of value-added concept of the petrochemical chain and to export the products into the Asian market, particularly the Japanese market. Now, we have never tried to get a policy of protectionism for Alaska as far as our products are concerned. It's a very interesting thing when you look at the other areas where we've developed export capability in the rest of the country. There's always been a demand for some sort of protectionism for that export industry. I've been, the 10 years that I've been in the Senate, I have not had the Alaska timber industry or the Alaska fishing industry come to us for any kind of protection with regard to their exports. We have had repeated inquiries about the barriers on the other end, but we don't have any, we're not seeking any subsidies, we're not seeking any special treatment in terms of the development of our economy with regard to trading. And I think that it's time that, on the other hand, that we stop being discriminated against. One of the interesting things that we've been going through, as you know now, for a period of at least 4 years, has been the question of the trade of Alaskan oil to Japan. It would be possible for us to send our oil to Japan to fulfill the Saudi contracts of selling oil to Japan, and to have them send, the Saudis send their oil to Boston to fulfill the contracts that have been made to sell Alaskan oil to Boston, and save each country $100 million a year in terms of tanker fees. It would save millions of miles of tanker traffic, of laden tanker traffic on the high seas. And it's beyond me to understand why, you know, grown men who are elected to the United States Senate can't comprehend that this is not a sale of Alaskan oil to Japan. But it's the record is replete with my debates with members from other states, including the current Vice President of the United States, who I had a discussion with him the other night, and he said to me that he's been looking it over, and for the first time he thinks maybe that he might understand why we'd want to do that, and he hopes the President will re-examine it. Well, I hope the President will too, because I just don't understand why we should be completely at the mercy of the Californians in terms of the ability to develop this Ohio pipeline to take that oil that some people call a glut from the Long Beach area over and put it in the Midland area and put it into existing pipeline system. We have, there is no reason for us to constantly be reacting to the pressure that develops from something like the excess production of sour crude on the West Coast, which is our situation. When we deal with a problem like this, we have to try to deal with it on the basis of reason. And if you look at the statistics, I would invite any of you to look at the statistics, even, and incidentally, our figures were based upon the use of American tankers to export Alaskan oil to Japan. They were not based on the use of foreign tankers. If you look at it, you cannot come to any conclusion but what the world would be better off if we developed the whole concept of a crude stream and required oil to be delivered from the place of production to the nearest place of consumption, and to have the computerized computation of sales and the savings equally divided or somehow or other divided between the producer and the purchaser. It would be such an easy thing to do. But the difficulty is that, again, we come back to the question, and that to me is the thing that You cannot have a conference like this without talking about it, and that's the political consequences of the each country's policies, foreign policies, with regard to our potential as far as Alaska's ability to enter into this export market. We have the ability to contribute substantially to a reduction in the balance of trade deficits. We have the ability, I think, to increase substantially the economy and the real sustained, slow, but I think legitimate and proper type growth that would come from the utilization of these lands in the interior that have agriculture capability. I believe, and we have suggested, that we create at least four new forests in the interior to emphasize the forest capability of interior lands. And it's not just southeastern that ought to be considered when we're talking about the export of Alaska's timber products. The interior forest could produce substantially in this area and could be related to export markets. But no matter what we do in terms of this area, we come back to political capability. I believe that we will see now a period of time develop where we are going to be at odds with the tuna industry, for instance. I think we're going to be at odds with some portions of the agricultural community as they realize the vastness of these lands that we have and the fantastic potential that's there if they're utilized. I'm confident that we're going to be, we already are in problems with some of the oil and gas industry that fears the movement of some of our petrochemical industries up here into Alaska, where we're nearer the these great resources of ours. And when it comes right down to it, perhaps it shouldn't be so blunt, but the development of Alaska's export capabilities and our relationship to these Asian, particularly East Asian countries, is going to be related to our political ability as a state to convince the other 50 states that we ought to be able to participate on an equal basis and have equal access to those markets. Now, that is a problem of strategy. I wish that I'd had the time, again, to sit through your whole program to participate with you in the discussions of that strategy. I've looked at the questions you've raised. I know that in every one of those discussions, there should have been the question of who's going to make the decision and how would it affect the established area of exports now, and what will be the relationship of our development to the total national policy involved in the relationship with the particular country involved. We've got a lifestyle in Alaska that I hope we'll be able to keep. I've seen the lifestyle in China. I do make repeated visits to Japan, and I admire that country very greatly. But I do think that the development of Alaskan policy with regard to this relationship, the decisions affecting that development and the decisions affecting the extent and nature of that relationship ought to be made here in Alaska. I do not think they ought to be made in Washington, and I would encourage more meetings such as yours to assure that that's the case. If any of you have any detailed questions of me, I'd be glad to try it. Answer them later. I don't know how long we'd go on. I would say this, that according to our clock, it's now 1:45 a.m. It's one of those interesting things that coming west is much easier than going east. But I do think that when you look at the question of going west, and that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about trying to take into our future the total relationships with a tremendous area, one that I think in some ways we have a lot more in common with than the eastern part of our own country. We ought to do more to encourage our participation in similar meetings in other countries. I was very pleased with the Alaska group that went to China. I would hope that we would develop more of those trips. I would hope that we would develop seminars and conferences such as this in some of the countries that we're talking about. We have a definite disadvantage because most of us, me included, are very deficient in languages. But I do think that we have a duty to develop the role that could be developed with these foreign emerging markets during our lifetime, because we're liable to miss them if we don't. Thank you very much for the invitation to be with you. I appreciate it.
Interesting and thought-provoking address. This illustrates once again, I believe, the wide-ranging nature of the topics which are covered under a conference such as this, and perhaps to a degree it explains the meaning behind the earlier Chinese saying, "Let politics take command." Thank you once again. Do you have questions for the senator?
Great, you know, that has a lot to do with China too, you know. You are a good friend because I want you to know he has my word. As a matter of fact, I'll work daily with Governor Hammond no matter who wins the problematic too, so you might go on my my answer to you is I'm just not going to take a position in my mind.
Thank you. with the technology. I was talking about the possible growth throughout the system. Lifestyle of rural Alaska, at the same time participate in an agricultural program that might last 4 to 5 months a year, or you could participate in the development of a fishery that lasts 3 months a year, and have your independence. And I think that where I'm coming from is I'll end up more independent with that kind of development than without it. I think that Alaskans have to look at the lifestyle they want, and that we have to recognize that we all don't want the same kind of lifestyle. And it may be that some areas of the state that have substantial land values that have agricultural potential don't want to develop it. There are some areas that have substantial agricultural potential in terms of timber that may not want to develop it. But I don't think, and here again I'm getting back now to a D2 inference, and I've admitted before I start, I don't think that we ought to try to impose that on one another. Because I think the decision ought to be made to a great extent by the people of the area as to how that development might affect their lifestyle. And some may decide that, that they're willing to take the risk of future budget cuts as far as dependency is concerned. I think overall that the Alaskan point of view will opt towards developing a minimum of self-sufficiency from federal controls, which is necessarily follow federal dollars. But I perhaps look at it a little bit more mundane point of view. I think I understand you, but I of necessity have to look at it. My friend reminds me three times in one statement when I'm on the Appropriations Committee, I hear him, you know, and it's really true. We have faced more constant demand for dollars in the last 10 years than any state in the union per capita. But I see it coming to a halt, and I try to convey to my friends here at home that we must see to it that we develop means to keep our profits here so we have some resident capital. We must try to see that we develop our renewable resource base so we cannot lapse into a dependency again when our non-renewable resources run out. And at the same time, I like to think that I remind them that the Alaska lifestyle is not compatible with total intensive technology. So somewhere in there, there's a balance. All right. Yes, sir. changes, might have to make up my own. And the problem with that bill is it takes the amendments that I put on the Outer Continental Shelf, or no, the Coastal Zone Management Bill, which were related to the onshore impacts of offshore development, primarily related to the potential to develop the Gulf and Bristol Bay and other areas of our state where we have very little established community capability to deal with such an enormous development that the potential is there. We committed a portion of the revenues from that activity, from OCS activities, period, to a fund which provides upfront money for communities to meet that that potential for impact development. The Randolph bill turns that around, I hope you realize, and it looks at areas that have already been impacted by resource development in the past, particularly the Appalachian area, and it says, in effect, that this generation ought to pay for the failure of past generations to recognize the advantage of the type of scheme that I worked out for the Coastal Zone Impact Amendments. Now, there are several of us who are involved in the Coastal Zone Management concept that are taking a long look at Randolph's bill. I think we have a fear. It's sort of like the Black Lung bill. I don't know if you've watched the Black Lung bill and the cost of it, but we've got to the point now where it ruled that the widow of a person who was killed in an automobile accident on the way to a mine job must be paid the black lung benefit, because had her husband lived and had he worked 30 years in the mine, he would have had black lung disease. The open-endedness of that authorization is staggering in terms of its impact on our deficit. And while I'm perfectly willing to support legislation that gives benefits to people who need the benefits because of something like black lung, I think we've seen some excesses. The briefings I've had so far on this bill lead me to believe that the impact of the Randolph bill will be that ultimately, we'll lose the money for things like we've already gotten the law. We need money. We got $50 million as a state on the Coastal Zone Impact Loan Fund this year, I'm sure you know. We're the first state to get that kind of money. We've got it in there. It's there for our community to borrow. To try to plan for, they must prove that they would be impacted, must at least establish they could be impacted by future oil and gas developments. And if they are impacted, they have to repay the money when they later develop the economy to come with it. If there is no impact, if the wells are dry, those loans will be forgiven. Now, you turn that over and put it on a basis of someone who's in an area like Appalachia that's already gone through the economy and had the development and had no resident capital developed. All the ills that we foresee and don't want to see happen here occurred in Appalachia. Put it on the basis of tying it to a resource basis rather than a social legislation. I'll support Appalachian reconstruction, Appalachian assistance programs, but to tie it to a resource base, that bill does. I raise serious questions because it's going to impede our resources. As a matter of fact, if I understand it right, the development of our resources here will pay a price. There'll be a tag hung on it for every ton of coal that will go into to pay the Appalachian impact. We're trying to compete in world markets. We're trying to compete elsewhere. I'm not sure we can bear that burden. I've got to study it more. I haven't made up my mind. But if that's the way it really is, that's the way my staff looks at it, right? I would have a hard time supporting that bill, too. Beyond that, we did get funds for this area. Not as many as we would have gotten had we known totally what happened in terms of the delay. The four-year delay, I don't want to raise all the hackles of what caused that delay, but when we got the pipeline going, it was like turning loose a seven or eight, eight contracts, eight segments. Well, it was more than that. How many contractors were there, Frank? Segments. I think it was 13 different projects on that. And they all went at the same time. In fact, there is a great deal different than what we'll do with the gas pipeline. But again, the problem is it's whether a unit of production in a new undeveloped area such as, well, let's take the North Slope. Should the North Slope, if it produces coal, pay into a fund to revive Appalachia, or should the taxpayers of the nation pay? There's some real policy, deep policy judgments about that, and I haven't come down on it yet. I know that in terms of the post-zone amendments, money is repaid for production off Alaska, if it's repaid at all. If it's not repaid, it comes out of the treasury to begin with, and it's the taxpayers of the country who pay for the ability of Yakutat or somewhere to get ready for the onslaught if it does come. We're sharing the risk as far as the development of that potential. Well, that's a different concept than this one where you're looking backwards and you're saying that 30 years ago they should have done the same thing. Now let's catch them up, but let's assess current production to do it. Man, that's got some real burdens for us as a coal-producing state, as a gas-producing state, as a timber producer. Where will we come on that if we put it on timber? I think it's about 3:30, so if you don't mind, I'll go to bed. Thank you.
I'd like to express my admiration for your stamina. Thanks to you all for coming. Appreciate your attendance. Beth and I are both fully aware of the interest that's been generated. We appreciate your questions, your comments, in particular your criticism. And I think you have helped to make this a much more stimulating event than perhaps people would have thought possible. Thank you, and good evening.